There we go. So, I'm making progress. They aren't graded yet. If you really want, if you're really curious about your grade, just like come by my office. I'll have my stack of them working on them like tomorrow and Wednesday morning. And like if you want to see it before class, otherwise, hopefully by lecture Wednesday, I will be bringing it in. I'm definitely a bit concerned about some of your understandings of the back and forth the Webster. Some of you are getting it, some of you are a little off. So we will be talking about them more in class today. Otherwise, questions? Yes?
Could we maybe, actually, is there a room to have, like, some extra time to do the assignment?
Oh, yes, I didn't talk about... So, how does Monday sound?
Sounds good.
Does Monday sound good?
For assignment 3.
Yeah, for assignment
3.
Okay.
Maybe we should have, like, a vote.
Sunday.
Well,
I got
okay. if people want, you know, I think Monday, I think, is kind of a good time, and they'll still give us a couple of weeks for the last assignment. I think I recall. Yeah, I was doing this on Friday. I was talking about this with folks because with 14th, so if we put it to Monday, it's the 18th, and then the last class is December 9th, I believe, that Monday. So we still then have, you know, so if it is the 18th, we still have, you know, if I give you the assignment this, you know, like soon after that, then you have one, two, you know, a few weeks for that last one. So let's try for Monday, yes?
Has anyone had any problems with the networking? Because I have my score updating and everything, but some of the packets get stuck on my pending all the time.
What? Yeah. Network connection? Are you saying the...
Yeah, like with the Ajax call.
Oh, so the idea of the Ajax call, if you don't return a response, that would imply a pending. If you do something and it doesn't actually return something. That's what I would think is if the Ajax call made a call and...
It's like what's happening is like I had it set for a second, but I set it to 5 seconds for the high score to update. Just because I was...
I
was, like, feeling it, I think, every second.
So one thing is that I didn't want you... Let's go forward here. So what I... This tutorial, this... I want to go to the assignment, assignment 3. So what I add was display the current high score for you at the bottom left corner. The updates as they happen. Okay, that... I'm willing to modify the assignment if you all are having problems with this. Is that this is the ideal, but it turns out that doing background, keeping the connection open, like there's this thing called long polling and stuff, is a bit tricky. And so I'm fine if you fake it, in the sense that the high score updates after... Basically, after each time the user does a letter. Like every time the user score changes, you can update the high score. That's perfectly fine. Now, of course, if you do that, that means you'll be doing a call to the server, which will have a response that will come back potentially later. But that's fine. You just set up the callback function to do that. So just do it. You can do it with every letter call. It doesn't have to be constantly in the background. I think that's probably a bit easier to do. If you can do this, that's great. But otherwise, I think you should be able to use the routines we talked about for doing this otherwise. Does that make it simpler for anyone? Let me just go ahead and do that right now before I... don't remember the password. Change the assignment. The timer shouldn't cause you a problem. In the background, with client servers. Alternately,
make it work, do you have to serialize? Like, is that, I was reading something about serializing calls. Like, is that how you would make that work?
So serializing is normally you're turning an object into a text stream or vice versa. Deserializing is when you do the opposite. You don't have to do that because we have higher level routines, which is what I wanted to talk about today. Because what I have here is code that should be a bit simpler. So this is the tutorial that we covered. Before I talk about this, is one other thing I want to talk about. But this is the tutorial we covered on Friday. I thought I would want to spend most of the lecture time today walking through this code and explaining all the fun bits about it, because there are a few tricky bits in this code, things that were not actually covered in the tutorial. My goal of the tutorial was to get you familiar with the code, but in fact it has a template for doing most of the stuff you want to do in the assignment. So if you understand this code, big chunks of the assignment are a lot easier. But before I did that, what I wanted to show you was, in order to turn this into, I've had some reports of people having difficulty with turning this into using jQuery.
Most of that stuff becomes deprecated once you go into jQuery anyways. The stuff at the top.
Well, deprecated in what sense?
Not required.
Well, you need to do the, in the sense of you don't have to set a variable to do it.
No.
Yeah, because you can just do it on the fly.
Yeah.
That's true. You can do that, but I wasn't anticipating you doing that. I was expecting you to just turn these into the equivalent jQuery terms. Now, first, doing that right there is pretty easy. You say dollar, I'll just say dollar, and then this is a selector, right? That's what gives you back. But that gives you back something different. It gives you back a jQuery object. Yes.
Do you always have to put the array at index 0 after each query?
No. So what is the index 0 thing? So if you want the actual DOM object in response to the query, you add an array subscript 0 after the call. You can access that. But you shouldn't need to do that for most of this, because because most of what this is being used for is for setting events, for defining an event handler. In that case, you're supposed to use the jQuery version. The only time you have to get the actual native object is if you're going to use the canvas object. So the canvas object is used here. This right here, you'll want to make this be, basically use the jQuery $ for this, but then you want to use bracket 0 for this. And the reason why you need to do that is because all the rest of these things use raw, this is considered to be a raw canvas, and this is a raw canvas context. You could change this to a jQuery-like equivalent. I looked a little bit into this thing called jCanvas, which is actually quite nice in terms of an API, but it's a completely different API, and you'll have to rewrite most of the code. I didn't want you to rewrite most of the code. I actually did my hand at it, and I felt that was kind of painful. So, yes?
Are there jQuery methods for the play function? Because that was the other one where I was having trouble.
Yes, there are. That's not what I want. Yes, if you go to the API documentation, you will notice that there is miscellaneous. Where is the... Do you ever find the audio part? I know it's there. I was making my solutions. I did change that.
Is it in the effects?
Effects? No, that's graphical effects, I think. This is traversing, utilities, no. Utilities, extensions, root, offset. Maybe it's, are you using effects or something? Clear view, resolve. Okay, I know what you're talking about. What you're talking about is in this portion down with the sound, where it says, where is that? Play, no. Is it a mouse event? Listeners. Okay, so these all you should be turned into jQuery equivalents, very simply. You can do basically the same thing with these two, although in our environment that we're testing it in, you can't really test these very well, so I'm not going to really pay attention to these, because of course you'd have to do that in a phone or a touch device, and we're doing development on desktops in virtual machines often, so... Yeah, I'm not expecting you really to make sure you get this part working because this is all touch events. These two, you can also, should be able to also get jQuery equivalents for those because that's, it's like, but what I was, play. Yeah.
It's trigger, trigger is the method and play is passive.
Okay, yeah, I see it. Yeah, I'll look for trigger.
It's not there. It's a jQuery documentation.
No. So, what was the code here you wanted
it's
to?
It's play, just play. There's no.
Aerosound play, you're saying.
Yeah
right. Because that's using that. Because that one breaks. Because that's a, if you do the jQuery transformation, that'll break. Or did I just do error sound bracket 0.play? I might have done that.
That's the one that I did.
Yeah. I feel like I'll post something online about this, because I could have sworn there was some... that there was actually a standard jQuery way of doing audio, but maybe I was just hallucinating or something. Anyway, so that's the big thing, is these things you will see as standard stuff. Make this, use brackets, 0 for this one, and I think maybe, the play one, I think that's also a reasonable one, and then change the event handlers. That's what you should need to do. Does that help? Okay. Other questions on the assignment details? Let me know before I can start walking through the code.
People use elements.
What I said about the what, sorry?
About the
pushing minimize for define every time. Okay, so what I in the original version of the assignment, what I said was I wanted to have it run in the background so it'd be continuously updated. So that whenever it is. So what that means is you have to leave a connection open, or what's called the standard technique is called long polling. That's one way of doing it, where you open a connection to the server. And you don't reply on the server side with a response until there's a change. And then once there's a change, then you return it. And then the client says, oh, I got my change. And then opens up another connection to wait for the next update. That's called long polling. So the idea is, in effect, it's polling the server, but it only gets new data when there actually is new data. It just basically leaves an open connection to it. So the way you'd implement this in Node is you would just have... You do the jQuery, you do the AJAX type call on the client, but what you do on the server is you wouldn't reply immediately. You'd actually wait, and you'd have to set up a background processing that when the you'd have to set up a callback for when the high score changed. So we haven't really talked about that. I mean, that's a little more advanced. If you want to do that, that's something cool. I'll show you how to do that later. But you can cheat with it and just have it every time you update the. Okay. Clear? Now just I don't know. Some of you might have missed this, but when I was talking about jQuery, when you convert this top portion to jQuery. Now, as you make all these objects, you set these equal to the dollar parentheses and the selector. What you get back is not the same as this. It does not return the same type of thing. It returns a jQuery object of which whatever this, you know, what this returns is a part of that object. So to get back what this query selector returns, turns out jQuery conventions, you just say bracket zero, the first part of, you know, the first, you know, the zero property of it will give you back the actual raw DOM object. And you need that because if the rest of the code relies on a raw DOM object, you need to give it that. And the canvas manipulation stuff and the sound stuff need that. But the event handlers, I don't want you using these raw event handlers, I want you to use the jQuery equivalents, and so they expect jQuery objects. Yeah.
Can make the container object as well? There's some problems with that. Like, it wasn't an easy state conversion. There was a lot of different...
No, that's what I say. The container object is the canvas, I think. Is it?
The very top. The first one.
No, it's in service.
Where is canvas?
That kind of stuff.
Oh, right, yeah. Easily. Right, that, yeah, you have to change that too.
So for that, would you use the raw DOM object or would you use the jQuery equivalent?
I was using the jQuery equivalent for that.
Okay.
Which is, I'm going to be a bit, if you take care of, if you do the raw accesses and you do the event handlers, you'll get full credit. But, yeah, certainly this can be done with, when you want to get offsets left and top and sub, jQuery has its own ways of getting offsets for objects. And so when in my solutions, I was using the jQuery equivalent of those. I mean, the purpose of this question is really about you getting somewhat familiar with, okay, when I say there's a jQuery way of doing it, and there's a standard browser way of doing it, I want you to have some idea of what we're talking about here. But I don't want to sit here and go, well, this method is means this, and this is how you do it in jQuery and stuff like that. I just want you to spend some time knowing about how things look in these two different worlds and understand why you might want to use jQuery as opposed to using the standard browser interfaces, that it's a bit cleaner. It's a bit more concise, a bit more flexible and stuff, and in addition to wrapping up incompatibilities between browsers. And just if you're doing client-side JavaScript, you should have some idea of these different APIs. So I thought this would be a useful exercise for you to give some idea of it, because, of course, to really become a master of this stuff, you have to spend a lot of time programming to the APIs. And I don't necessarily want you to spend huge amounts of time doing that. Okay, so that's, I'm really looking, this is an exercise, say, go look at jQuery, go look at some of the standard, you know, documentation on these browser APIs, and understand how they fit together. In a simple way. Go on to the tutorial code. By the way, I had this vision for a web application for use in class this afternoon. The idea is that it would be something that would allow you all to ask a question, and then I could turn the question around directly into a poll or something that does get everyone else's views real quick. And also maybe the next part of it was maybe doing interactive, everyone doing collective note-taking or something. So we have to try building that for next term or something. But I'm just kind of curious, does that sound at all kind of interesting, or does it sound kind of like...
Have you ever heard of
polling? So I actually spent some time looking at what's out there. What I got the impression of, and I looked at several of these, and I think I saw Poll Everywhere as one of them, but it seemed like they were mostly geared towards more static polls.
Yeah, it's something you'd have to have.
Right, exactly. And so the whole idea is that, you know, my lectures aren't exactly very preset. So most of these solutions saying I have to come up with, you know, five questions beforehand that I'm going to ask you during class, and I come up with a really great question in the middle of class, and here I can go and raise your hands or something like that, and sometimes people respond, sometimes don't. What if I could, you know, do the equivalent of that? And actually, could I do that in equivalent to someone saying, oh, I have a question, I mean, raise your hand and say, oh, I asked question, for, you know, 47. I go to the list, 47, everyone says, okay, let's, oh, that's a great question. Let's see what everyone else thinks of this. Turn around a couple of seconds and use that, because I hate these, some of these technology, classroom technology things are designed for me dumping information at you guys, and it seems like, what's the point of using all that stuff if I can't make it more interactive? How is Wi-Fi in this room? It's still pretty crap, isn't it? It's better now? It's better?
It's okay today.
It's okay today, yeah. See, that's the one thing. If I do anything like this, I think most of you could either have a laptop or a... Who here does not have an internet-connected device on them right now? Anyone? You don't have to be, I don't necessarily want you using it right now, I'm saying, but you don't, but you have one with you, and it's like, yeah, so, because I was just looking at some of the technology, like, just, so what, some of these companies want to charge you guys, like, $20 a year, to be able to respond to questions in class, and some, and other folks have, you know, all these, there's all these companies now getting into the space, and they're sort of going like, what? So if you hear me start talking about this in later classes and start showing you pieces of it as I try building it, that's what I'm doing. So first off, by the way, this is the same tutorial as there. I didn't change anything except I dumped all the code that you're using into here. Because I realized it would be a little easier to talk about it if it was here. So what? First off, let's look at package.json. So this is telling us the dependencies. What's different about this? It should look pretty normal, except I've added one thing. The validator. Now, we've been using Jade, we've been using Stylus, we've been using Express. Yeah, everything's fine. But this validator line is new. It's because I added a dependency, not in app.js, here. I added sanitize, is requires validator.sanitize. And that is used for one call. That line right there. Well, I can just highlight it persistently. Oops. What do you think that line does? Let's just, basically, yes, it's exactly what it does. Well, it doesn't remove them, it escapes them. So, what if you were to take the player's name and display it as part of the room's description? This is text that came directly from the player, and it's being incorporated into a page. This is a pattern that, in general, you should go, uh-oh, when you're building a web application. Whenever you take input from a user, before that input can be incorporated into a web page, it has to either be thoroughly parsed and extracted or sanitized. The reason why is because otherwise, you could allow the person to insert code into your web page. It could be stuck right in the middle of your page, could be some code, running JavaScript, accessing the DOM, doing whatever your client-side code can do in the context of your page. This is called a cross-site scripting attack, and it is one of the most common security flaws on the internet. So I thought at this point in the term, I should be starting to talk about these issues in a little more operational way. So I thought at least let me show you a little bit of good practice, which is before I save this variable to the session variable, I thought, okay, I've just gotten it from the user. Let's make sure it's clean. So the request, yes, basically I sanitized player escape because I set players equal rec body player. So now it's safe to display. Fun exercise, maybe try, which I may show you all, is incorporate this into a description there and then show how it can lead to a cross-site scripting attack. Now, Node actually has some mechanisms, actually in Jade, there are some mechanisms to do this escaping for you when you display variables. But I would tend to say sanitize sooner rather than later, because you might forget to sanitize it when you present it to the user, and if you just store it sanitized, you're better off. Yes?
I believe that XQCD has a good comic on this one.
Oh, yes. Which one was that? I can just pull it up.
XQCD.com/3275.
Which one?
327.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is, but this is not... This is...
Not the web version, but...
Yeah. Johnny Drop Tables. You all have seen this, right? You haven't seen this one? Okay, this is a great comic. So what's happening? So can you all read this? This is actually...
Yeah, go for it.
So you see here, did you name your son Robert, close parentheses, semicolon, drop table students? Semicolon, dash, dash. So what that is, that's SQL for deleting a database table. So by adding, if they did not do proper sanitization when they entered this into their database, this got entered in, this ended up being a command, and this deleted their database of all their students. Or deleted the table containing all their students. Because that's what happens when you drop a table. It's like, gone. And so, so she named her son's name officially an SQL injection.
Her daughter's name is Help, I'm Trapped in Driver's License Factory.
All right.
That's over.
All right, this one. That's... Okay, anyway, so input validation in various forms. Okay, that's where it's used. That's the only place I've done sanitization. That's the only user input I took other than clicking on the links. So it's pretty, that should be fine. So here now in our app, this is our standard app things, all standard boilerplate stuff, this stuff. All I've done here is I've added a few more routes. I've added a get contents, and a get for game and get contents, and a quit and do action. Well, the do action. So if you recall, in the older version of the adventure game, which you had, which versions of which you had on the midterm, and versions of which you had in a previous tutorial, this was more complicated. How was this part more complicated? Do you remember? This was the make room handler part, where we had a function that we called to create more functions to generate all the handlers on the fly. So the idea is that here it would go through the room data, the room data structure, the room object, and find out what all the rooms were and create handlers for each of those room names. We don't have that anymore. We do not have URLs specific to individual rooms anymore. Once you're playing the game, you're in the game URL. And there's a get contents. But otherwise, nothing in the URL bar reflects where you are in the game. So, notice how the server has become dumber. It doesn't have knowledge of the specific URLs. Now in routes, we have a bit more logic, but again, it's not that complicated. So what is it? So here the index, this is the same stuff. Start, it's the same stuff, except now instead of going to, we say the current room is the bridge, and we redirect to /game, not to /bridge. So this is, we do two things, but before what we did is we redirected to /bridge. And so what we do is we say the rec session current room equals bridge, and then go there. So the idea is that whatever room the player is in the current session is denoted by the string here, this current room property of the session. That is what room they're in. So then now we go to the, and so quit just does the same thing as before, redirects us to /game. What it does is now, this is the thing that renders slash game. All it does is it calls render room.jade with the title adventure demo and that. So look, this has all become really simple. It's not doing much on the server here. It's just calling the template. The template doesn't even have much logic in it. It's just getting a title. It's not accessing any complex JavaScript variables in the server. It's not doing anything. But then, that's what game is. And then there's do action. What does do action do? It just says, if it's moved, set the current room to room and sends, return success. Otherwise, return invalid action. And that's just for the body, action and room. This is for a form that comes up. We have two properties. We just basically say, you want to move from one room to the other? This is what you do. Instead of following links, we do posts to the server to move between rooms. And I generalize it instead of saying, I could have just had a do move action. I instead made it do action because I could have had the other movement, other things that happened. I could have had pick up object or whatever my adventure game wanted to have. I had all those commands in here. And then the last thing that we do is just get contents, which is, this rec, what does this res send do? So this, first of all, this is rooms, rec session current room. So it sends the current room object to the client. What is this? Do you know what rec send does? Has anyone looked this up yet? Or response send, sorry. So this is a handy little bit of Node.js magic, which what it does is if you want to send something back to the client, you can just say send. And this is designed for Ajax. Because in particular, you can just give it a string, it'll send the string. If you want to send an object, it will convert it to JSON and send it. So you don't have to do any sort of serialization manual or anything like that. You say, here's an object, send it to the client. And use the other proper, other routines I'll show you on the client, and it just converts it back into a JSON object. Now the fun part, you notice the server has in many ways become simpler than the old one. But the complexity now has moved a bit more into the client. This is the client code. First, before I go into anything else, what's up with this open paren function, open close paren, followed by this? That's what the outermost thing's happening. What is that little bit of magic? Yes? Stop from including the global scope. All we are doing is in creating a function on the fly that's going to be called once in order to limit everything to the scope of this file. See, if you didn't do this, any variables that were declared at the top level of this file, so this is not like a node on the server. A node on the server, every file has its own JavaScript context. On the client, in the browser, each file you include does not have its own JavaScript context. They actually exist in the context of the page. They all get loaded in there. If you want any sort of separation, any sort of privacy, the only way you have it is by doing things within functions. So we want to have our own little scope here so that any local variable stuff we create, any routines we call, they can't be called from the outside. So that's what we do. We just say, open parentheses, here's a function. And we put the parentheses here because then I can close the parentheses here and then call it. That's what that open paren allows me to just say, here is some expression. It turns out the value of that expression will be a function. And then I have the open close parentheses at the very end right here, just execute it. So I define an anonymous function, and I call it. So you just expect to see in a lot of standalone JavaScript code,
in the browser, on the browser, you'll see this sort of pattern where you just define an anonymous function and then call it immediately, because now everything inside of here is effectively private.
If that doesn't make sense to you, we should discuss a little bit because it's kind of important, but hopefully now you're seeing a bit why we had to talk about closures and scoping and all this stuff a lot earlier on, because it's right in your face when you work in the browser.
So now in here, what I've done here is I've defined one function, getRoom. I define this function, getRoom, and I say, when the window is loaded, call getRoom.
So this code will be loaded at some point during the page's initialization, early on and stuff, but after the page is loaded completely, it will now call this code and actually run it. So, because we only really want this after the page has been fully rendered.
So, what does this code do? It just has this function getRoom. What does getRoom do? At a high level, what does it do? Think of it this way. Did the server put the description and name of the room on the page? No, not at all. Just to reiterate that, let's go to room.jade. What is this?
It says it creates a headline. Well, first off, it includes the adventure script. Now, really, this should be in the header, not in the content, but I got lazy because I didn't want this included on the main page, so I'll leave as an exercise how you'd make it so it would only be on the header in this page and not the other one. But, so you included the code, then here we've got a headline, H1, we get an identifier title, and we just say room name. Then we say room description, which is a paragraph, and then we say here is, and then we make a list of go-to and the exit lists and exits. One button for exits, and then...
So some of you may have seen this page at certain points. Especially when you're messing around with the code, because what this shows is this is the page before the JavaScript has gotten onto it, and what it basically says is just room name, room description. It's got nothing there. That all has to be filled in, and the way it's filled in is by the client-side JavaScript. So what the client-side JavaScript in fact does is it edits this page as presented on the client. It edits the DOM. It makes calls. It puts what the real room name is in here. It puts the real room description here. It changes all the exits to the proper exits for this room. Turns them into buttons. The buttons that are created here, when the action happens, it calls the do action operation on the server. So the interesting part of this application is really all in this function right here. So you really need to understand this code. And this code's a little bit trickier than the rest. So you'll notice we've got jQuery calls here. So first is this $getJSON, getContents function room. What's that line? You really need it. We need to parse this line by line. We've got to understand what every part of this thing is doing, because this is a little dense. So just reading it logically, get JSON. It said, get a JSON object. From where? From the server. You know, at what URL. Here's the URL, /getContents. So what are you going to send to the server? An HTTP get request for /getContents. And remember, we had a routine that does that. What does that routine do? It's up here.
getContents is a simple function. All it does is it says send rooms rec session current room. Now, some of you saw that this might not be the safest strategy. Because it's not being very picky about this. Notice it's going to send any room that's asked for. Well, no, sorry, take it back. This function's fine. Because we say rooms rec session current room. Who sets current room? You set it. So do action can mess it up. But this routine is not at fault. We assume that the current room is a valid current room. So we just send that back as a JSON object. So we send it, then we... So it says, okay, give me that, and then call a function room. So that means that whatever this returns, this will return an object. Well, actually, what it's going to do is it's going to return a page kind of thing. But in that page, your HTTP response, in that will be an encoded JSON object. jQuery will happily turn that into a regular JavaScript object. And it will give it the name room, because we're passing it as an argument to this function. Ask for an object, get an object. Now we've got an object over here. So magically, from the server, we had an object, a JSON, an object in JavaScript, and now on the client, we have an object in JavaScript, which is the particular room that we're in. Yes?
What happens if we send more than one object to the client?
I have to look at the API, but I'm pretty sure that send only takes one object. I think. But if you want more than one thing, it's simple. You just wrap them up inside a bigger object. Right. You want 20 things, make it a bigger object and give it 20 properties, and those are the sub-objects. So you can send as much as... This isn't a limiting interface. Again, because JavaScript is so flexible. So what does that room look like? Remember, this is what the rooms object. So what we're sending is this, or this, or this. Except that the name we're given for this thing, instead of engineering, it'll be on the client side, it'll be room, and then it'll have a title, description, room exits. So the rest of this function is all about taking that and updating the page. Now, you might notice that this var exits isn't used. That shouldn't be there. I had put it in there while creating my code, and I forgot to remove it. So var exits doesn't do anything. That happens sometimes. But then here, now we have these queries for saying, okay, title. So this is where the neat thing about jQuery is. So I'm saying in the DOM, whatever has a property ID of title, value of title, replace it with this string, which is H1, ID equals title. Now, why do I do this? Because I'm replacing the entire node. So if I don't put this in, I will not have any way of changing it the next time around if I don't include that ID value. So H1, ID equals title, plus room title, plus H1. So room is there. We assume it has a property of title because it came from the server. We're filling it in. Yes?
How do you replace the entire node instead of using text for that?
I could. That might be simpler. So this is the one thing when you're doing DOM editing. What this replace with is, it says that you replace the node with exactly what it is. It's not edit text. And so you're right. I wasn't thinking of it that way. I was just thinking of just editing the DOM. Yeah. But actually, this is probably good for education purposes, because you can see this is how you change the page to be arbitrary things. So again, this is replacing the title. Here, the description, we're replacing that node with exactly what it's going to be. It's the arrow ID description plus room description plus that. Now, this code's a little bit different.
why can't I just do a simple replace on this?
It's because you've got more than one exit.
Right. And I don't know how many exits I have. So there's a list of nodes. So remember, this is an unordered list. And I don't know how many exits there are. And I want to make sure that I don't leave old exits here. So instead of defining these as IDs, I define it as a class. The class is dot exits. So that's why it's dot. So I say remove all the dot exits. So that blows away all of them. And then I add them back. I add them back as the child of the for each. You know, so room exits for each function the exit. So I have this for each call on the room exits portion, which I, you know, so room was an object. Room exits is a sub-object of it. And then so for each property in it, I've got this. And I call, go through it, say, hash exit list append. So that's a name for that list object. And I add to it. So remember, the append in a DOM is really adding a subtree object thing. So beneath the, let me show you what I'm talking about here. So here I said, no, that's an index room. So here I had an exit list, and I gave it the ID exit list. And under here I gave, I gave these all the class exits. So when I deleted all the exits, I deleted all of these. But here I'm saying add in as a child of this. These all get added in as a child. So I do two operations. First I add the button, and then I add an event handler. This says make the button. The classes, this button default is all Bootstrap styling. And then here I say, okay, plus the exit. So I'm referring to a specific node of the exit. And I say on click. When someone clicks the mouse, what do they do?
Calls a post or do action.
Post is another AJAX call. These all underlying use this AJAX function for doing these things in the background. This makes it more convenient. Yes?
Is there a new way to use Java instead of Bootstrap for building
HTML? Good question. So, why can't I use Jade? It's on the client. I'd require a Jade compiler in the client. I think they might exist, but I have not really looked at that. I think you probably include a client-side library and have it parse Jade, because Jade, after all, is JavaScript. The Jade template engine is written in JavaScript. But I haven't looked into that. So normally you don't do that. But yeah, you might want to do something like that. There are all kinds of little languages that you can incorporate into the browser to do things, but that's more code that has to be downloaded to the browser to be executed.
So this do action, we say, you know, again, we're defining a form. We're doing a, here's the post, here's the URL, and here is the body of the post. Nope. Now, notice there's a little bit of closure action here. Where is the value of the exit coming from? That's an argument to the function.
So not so much, but...
So, I mean, it looks a little confusing. Hopefully you see that all it's doing is, this is just, you know, it's
replace the title, replace the description, replace all the exits. You replace the exits by deleting all the exits and recreating each one. In order to create each one, you make a button, and then you add a click handler for it to do things when it gets clicked.
Can you explain how that function gets the, so in the for each loop, how is that at the exit getting into each call of the for each
loop? Well, how are you getting into, how is this room exits for each working?
Yeah, so, well, I guess for each loop will do
for each statement?
It's going to call this function for every property of room exits. Right? Remember what room exits look like? So this is an array. Sorry. The for each works for... Okay, so this is a... remember, we've got room exits is an array here. And so all we're doing is we're going to iterate through this array, but rather than writing a loop to iterate through it, I don't care about the order in which I iterate. I just need to do something for all of them. It's here I just say for each. And so I'm calling this function on each of these, on each of the elements of the array.
It automatically knows that I get assigned the scope of... So the exit variable inside of that function?
Well, it's because it's the argument. The argument to the function gets the value of the array that we're now operating on.
I've never seen it written that way before, but yeah, let's see how it works.
So this is, for those of you who have seen this sort of things, it's kind of like map, except that we don't actually care about the results. So this is... What we're essentially doing is taking an array and applying and having a function and running that function on each element of the array. If you can do exactly the same thing with map, except that the result of the functions will then be gathered together. Look up this for each thing. It's a really cool little thing. I can talk about it more later if you have questions. Or I can talk about it now. I mean, how mysterious is that to you all? This is one of those times where I'd really like to get a poll of everyone. Yes?
I don't think it's so much the for each as the fact that the exit gets redefined on every iterative step somehow that I don't really follow. Like this, the exit variable is redefined without you defining it as anything.
Right. So what is this function thing? Now, this function thing means exactly what it has always. This is like a callback function. Right. Well, it is a callback function. It's a function that we're defining that's going to be called by something else. We're passing it as an argument to a function. So we're saying to this for each routine, we're giving it a function. And it is going to call it some number of times. Whenever it calls it, it gives it one argument. And the argument it gives it is the element of this array that it's currently on. So this is iterating through it. That's where the array is coming from. It's just coming from, it's an argument to the function. Does that help? Does this for each thing can kind of, or confusing? What, huh?
It makes sense until I actually do it on my own.
Well, think of it this way. If ever you are trying to, you've got an array, and you need to do something for every element of the array, what do you normally do? You'd write for I equals 0, I is less than, you know, whatever the length of the array, I plus plus, and then you'd have some body that does stuff to it. I hate those constructs. It's like, you've got all these details that if you mess up any one of them, the loop is broken, but you're basically always doing exactly the thing. I'm iterating over the entire array. You know, are you iterating over the entire array minus the last five elements? No. Are you iterating over every other element? No. I mean, those are the kind of things you can do with a for loop, but you never do it. You iterate over the whole loop, over the whole array. So this is just, these kind of constructs are saying, you're doing it over the whole array? Okay, do it over the whole array. I'll just say that. And the style here is that what is the thing I want to do for every element of the array? Well, I make it a function. I'm going to pass it along. So this is, when people talk about functional programming, this is actually a lot of times what they're really referring to is saying, oh, I've got something I want to do. I'm going to create a function and do it and use it. As opposed to just having some sort of block, which is what you have with a classic C-style for loop. It's not that you can't do the classic C-style for loop. This is perfectly implementable using a classic C-style for loop. I could have just said var I and have a for I equals whatever and find out the length of this and blah. I could have done that completely. I just didn't.
Different from the regular for each loops that we're used to seeing.
Right. You're using the for each loops with it. Again, this is a more functional one. Because here it's for each is a method of this object, and that object is an array. Array objects have, in JavaScript, have a standard method called for each. When you see these sort of constructs, when you learn new programming languages, you will every so often come across these constructs which look kind of like what you're used to, but then seem kind of different. Whenever you see those, I think it's very important to say, well, why didn't you just do it this way that I'm used to? Well, in general, it's not because you couldn't do it in the other way. It's just because they do it this other way. It's a style difference. I wouldn't say it's better or worse per se, or runtime, it's just different style. And really, that's it for this. I mean, the only other thing I think that's at all interesting is this button group stuff. Which is, how did I make my buttons nicely line up on the page? And that's just bootstrap stuff. Turns out you can define these button groups, and so you say that this list is a button group, and then you say that, you know, each is a button, style as a default button, nothing special about it, and then this exits is per my code. When you use things like Bootstrap, you spend minimal time deciding how things should look, and instead you just describe it. So, good? So we just have, so I've run a bit late here now. I kind of was in the middle of things. I didn't want to kind of break it up, but we've got another 15 minutes or so. So if you all can, maybe we can just go for another 10 minutes or so, or kind of finalizing things. But this is good. So I'm trying to think about, maybe I should talk a little bit about, that's one thing I want to talk about. Let me go back to that. Just, of course, after you delete a page. Every so often I hear that thing and I never use it. Control Shift T, I should remember that.
Or Shift T or Control.
Oh, well, that's what I wanted to do. So, this stuff. So, you're loading in the jQuery code. This is the minified version. Minified meaning it's removed all the comments and all the extra spaces and everything. So, if you're actually trying to understand jQuery, don't look the minified version. Look for the jQuery.js. But so this code is loaded in. What context? What JavaScript scope does this execute in? Come on. What?
Being loaded as part of the head, so I'm guessing global?
It's loaded in the JavaScript context of the page. Every page in... So global, you could say, but the key thing to understand is that every web page defines its own JavaScript scope. Just like every file in Node defines its own JavaScript scope. Here, there is, again, a file, but there's in the browser, there's only one file. Even if you include other files, there's only one file. When you say script,
What it means is that this code is, it's like that code is literally inserted into the page at that very line. So the semantics are fundamentally different from Node. In Node, when you evaluate a file, every file has its own JavaScript context. They're isolated. That's why you have to use the exports mechanism and requires in order to get code moving in one or the other. In client-side JavaScript, the equivalent to the requires line is this script line. And when you include, but when you include a script, the semantics are different because it's literally like it's just been inserted. It's actually equivalent to include in a C file. Have you all run GCC with a dash V option?
What did you say?
Have you ever run GCC, GNU compiler, or G++, any of the GNU compiler tools, with a dash V option? Verbose. If you have not done this, the next time you compile a program in C or C++, run this. And the reason why is that you will see exactly what is happening. It turns out it's doing a whole bunch of stuff. In particular, it's running multiple programs. It's running the main C compiler, it's running the assembler, and it's running the C preprocessor, the C compiler, and the assembler, and if you're doing linking, the linker. You know, so you'll see the execution of all these different programs and what it includes and stuff, and you'll see, oh, that object file is being included. That's how that got in there and stuff. It's quite instructive. But the reason why I mention it here is that as part of that compilation process, you can give GCC options that will output a version of your program with all include files included in it. So you might have four includes at the top of your file. GCC produces at the intermediate stage a file with all of those incorporated directly into your C program. And you can see that output. That's semantically exactly what's happening here. Now, would it be nice if it had something a little more sophisticated like Node with separation? Yes, but that's not how client-side JavaScript works. But we can fake it. And that's what the whole function scoping is. Now, what I wanted to end on is what are the implications of this for client-side JavaScript? The fact that there is no separate scope for all these different files.
Every time you load the page, you have to send the script over?
Well, every time you load a page, the script is loaded. So every page that loads jQuery will load the script. That's one reason why when they talk about client-side JavaScript, you often don't necessarily want to load. If it's a standard library, you don't necessarily want to load it from your own site, but you sometimes want to load it using a canonical from a content distribution network URL because it's possible that the browser, the user's browser, will have that cached. So instead of loading it over the network, it will just use their local copy. So you don't necessarily have to copy it every time, but you just can use what's already there. But that's what I'm thinking of. How do you, when you make a web page and you want to add a Twitter feed and you want to add a Google search box and you want to add some AdSense and you want to add a YouTube video or you want to add, a Facebook like button or something, how does that all work? You know, what's the basic mechanism for that? Do you know?
Grabbing code from those other sites and inserting them into your own page?
That's exactly what it is. They're just script for the most part. Basically, you generally have some sort of script tag, maybe with a little bit of extra code in there to call things. That's basically how all of them work. They could give you HTML to do things and other things, and in fact, they often generate some HTML, but it's all based on JavaScript. The JavaScript's loaded, and it does all the stuff. And the reason why they do that is because it makes it nice and easy. Makes it really easy to incorporate. You don't have to do any setup. You know, you just put the code in and it figures out how to look pretty on your page. But that means that you're loading code that runs in your page along with all of your code.
And you have little to no idea of precisely what that code is doing.
Let's say today I say, I'm not sure about what Google's doing with their, you know, AdSense code. Let me download Google's AdSense code and let me look at it and see what it's doing today. Okay, I understand it today. I think it's doing nothing fishy today. Tomorrow, is that code going to be downloaded to my webpage? No, maybe not. Maybe a completely different version of the code. Maybe I download on one website and then I create a new website. And for some reason, Google decides to serve a completely different version of the code to the second website than to the first website. So first off, you don't know exactly what code you're incorporating. It changes from day to day, minute to minute, site to site. And it runs in the same execution context as the rest of your code. You can protect your code. That's the whole point of conventions like this. Wait. This whole convention here with this function, that's to protect your code. But it's not completely safe. Because while you have private JavaScript access in here, there is a global data structure that you have to contend with. The DOM. The DOM is global. Everyone potentially has access to the DOM. Unless you restrict access. But if you restrict access to the DOM, generally, those other scripts will break because they wanted to add something to your page. So now you're loading in this code. It's all accessing the same DOM as your code is. What's to say that code is not looking at whatever it wants or changing your web page in completely arbitrary ways? Like, for example, think about all the pages on the internet that have something included, have Google Ads on it. What if Google decided they wanted no one talking about Carlton? No one in the world talking about Carlton. How hard do you think it would be to change the code that they serve to everyone's web page to do a search through the text of the DOM, look for the word Carlton, and delete any nodes that contain Carlton? Would that be a very complicated code? Not at all.
Probably get found out relatively quickly and be a very expensive scandal.
Well, you'd think. But how would you know? What if they just did it for an hour? What if they just did it for a day? What if they just did it for people at Carlton? You know, they could do it just to pages served at Carlton. Or pages served to people who are geolocated in the Ottawa area. How would you notice? Is there someone around here checking all the time?
Could you create a copy of the DOM and only let those scripts use that?
So the security pattern, things about how you can do this, that there are tricks you can do, and in fact there's an entire... don't like me, huh? I think maybe it got overheated or something. So I could start talking to you about the security literature, about how people have tried to add things to secure your web pages against such things. And there are some things you can do. But it's not easy. It's not easy at all. It's not supported by default. So if you want to write the completely paranoid web page that incorporates the Google code, you might be able to do that. But the trouble is, any stuff that you do, it might break whatever code you incorporate. And it might not break it today, but then you include a new version of it, and it might break that. Because, and some of these pages really, you could say that, okay, maybe this one only needs read access, but what if anything's like inserting a video into your page? It needs write access. It has to insert the video stuff, the flash element or the video tag or whatever. How do you get, you know, what you really want to say is, I want to give you write access and read access to only this portion of a page, only this subtree of the DOM, not any of the rest of the DOM. That does not exist in current web browsers. I have had a PhD student struggle for quite a while with trying to implement such things, and it's not so easy to modify a browser to do that. I think it shut down completely. Okay. but yeah, I wanted you to think about, like, this is your the implications of this are quite significant, these little design decisions. And in fact, you run across them every day when you surf the web. And this is why applications... Have any of you tried NoScript? Okay, all of you, if you have not done this, I would like you to, before the next lecture, go install NoScript for your favorite browser and try surfing the web with it. Okay, it's a well-known extension. It's available for Firefox and I believe for Chrome now. So it's called NoScript. And what NoScript does is it turns off JavaScript. It turns off the loading of JavaScript on a per-domained basis. And it does some other things too, try to improve security. I want you to play with it, and I want to know what you think of it, because this is a common thing of saying, you want to be secure on the web? Run NoScript. Try it out, and tell me what you think of it. I'm very curious. I won't say anything more. Have a good couple of days. See you Wednesday.